everyone. Welcome back. Hope you had a good week. I'm Henrik Palmgren. RedIceCreations.com is the website where you can both educate yourself and also learn more about the largest ongoing population replacement experiment anywhere. We also cover a lot of other topics, of course, but our dear Mother Europa, our continent, is being transformed every day now. And we do feel the urgency that something has to be done about this now before it's too late. That's why we talk about this. That's why it's important. And it would be to any people if this was happening on their continent. Our focus today is on my home country, Sweden, once again, the canary in the multicultural coal mine. Our guest is Lars Holger Holm. He's a Swedish author and violinist. He has written on a variety of subjects, such as the European musical tradition. He has written for publications like Svenska Dagbladet, Expressen, and a contemporary magazine, Salt. He spent several years as a host on the classic music radio station, Stockholm Classic FM. A number of his books are published through Arctos, including The Owls of Afrasiab, Homo Maximus, and Hidden in Broad Daylight. Lars is with us following the publication of his latest book, Kärringstaten, The State of Bitches. As a longtime deviator from the Swedish conformist mindset, he has some very pertinent input on the rapid freefall of Sweden that has gained momentum since the enactment of the EU's open border policy. We have a lot to discuss today, from the assassination of Prime Minister Olof Palme to the noble Swedish virtues of kindness and trust, and how these are being exploited as large-scale migration transforms its traditional civilization into a dangerous battleground of social class conflict. We also talk about the rise of Protestantism, Marxist-based feminism, and more on European culture. Lars Holger, welcome so much to Red Eyes Radio. Thank you so much for coming on the show with us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've been enjoying your latest book. It's in Swedish. It's called Kärringstaten, a term that is, we struggle a bit with the translation, but we could do, I think we can do it justice. Kärring could basically mean bitch or crone. So perhaps the bitch state or the crone state would be a good translation. I think you had another term, didn't you, on that?
No, I don't really know the term crone, to be quite honest. But a state of bitches is perhaps one of the possible translations. I mean, it's a pretty untranslatable word in the first place, as you know. But I guess a bitch state of crones, crone state of bitches. Yeah,
that's as good as any.
That
exactly.
With me.
It gets the point across. I think the term used to be more of a term of fondness that you expressed to someone.
Yes,
but I think it changed over time.
I
right?
I thought about that myself. That actually kärring in Swedish is also something that has the term dearness about it, doesn't it?
That's true. Exactly. So anyway, I want to talk more about the book today. There's a lot of good things in there. We have a number of topics lined up, obviously getting deeper into the question of Sweden, what's happening there, and the future of our country. But do you want to tell us just a little bit about yourself, about your background first? I mean, when did you kind of disconnect from the, or started to deviate from the conformity of the Swedish mindset and go on to write the kind of books that you do today?
Well, the thing is that I think it goes back pretty far in time, as a matter of fact. I started very early to be very aware of that there was something wrong with the Swedish society. And I was pretty young. I think the turning point came when I was about 28 years old. And that's when I realized that this society is not livable any longer. And the reason for this was actually Olof Palme, our prime minister who was assassinated in, was it 1986?
I believe it was 86, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was in February or something like that in 1986. And that was, for me, that was a turning point right there. Because I thought that he had already, back then, I thought he had already destroyed the Swedish society with his politics. And that was during the heyday of the Social Democrat Party in Sweden.
Yeah, I mean, many saw him as a great statesman, and obviously...
Yeah, they saw him as a hero, and I know in other countries as well.
Yeah.
But I do believe that he caused a lot of harm to the Swedish society, and that was my feeling back then. And of course, today, I don't really know what he did exactly, but I would say though that he was instrumental in causing what we see as effect today of the Swedish society. He was the one that founded. There were a lot of things. Well, if you ask me the right questions, I could probably answer you. But this is what I feel about Olof Palme. He was nefarious to the Swedish society.
Yeah, I mean, I agree totally. I think that he opened the borders, as so many other countries. I mean, America did it in 1965 with the Immigration Act. But in Sweden, I think was it 72 or 75 or something like that when he really opened up the borders?
Well, his idea, I think, was pretty clear. And it was a leftist idea, of course, to bring in all. I mean, he was anti-American, first of all. And his idea was to bring together all the people or create a refuge in Sweden for all the people that had been somehow attacked or harassed by Uncle Sam. And so we got these waves back then already of Chilean refugees, Nicaraguan refugees, and they all came in waves, Vietnamese, you name it.
Yeah, exactly. Was it was when Pinochet, for example, came to power in Chile, all the lefties,
yes.
So they left.
Yeah. But these people, as opposed to today, were actually, I mean, they're Christians and they belong somehow to the Western Hemisphere in their values and so forth and so on. So I think the Chileans, for example, were easily integrated into the Swedish society, and they now occupy posts in the Swedish society, etc., etc. So I don't think that was. But his idea was that the socialists of the world should have a refuge in Sweden.
Yep, and it seems to have been done the trick, doesn't it? Because leftism overall, the kind of environment we have in Sweden is probably stronger there than in many other countries around the world.
Yes, absolutely. The I mean, he was the one who wanted to map Sweden as the country where we receive these refugees from all over the world, but primarily the ones who had been attacked by the United States. I think that was his idea.
Yeah. The more I learned about him as I went, I said, thank God he was assassinated. I mean, the last thing he did, the Employee Investment Fund or the Löntagarfonden, is unbelievable step in that direction of actually taking and claiming all the assets, the profits from private corporations and putting them back into the state. I mean, that's incredible.
Yes, and it was it was a huge failure too.
Absolutely, it didn't work, and I think there was what was pushed him over the edge, so to speak, and people just said that's it, we're not having this, you know.
Yeah, and then he was also meddling. He was stepping over the border somehow, because he was also meddling in arms trades and stuff like that. And this was never investigated. One of the things that happened with Palme was that he was assassinated, and nobody really, really investigated where he had been prior to the assassination. The thing was that he met with Rajiv Gandhi in India. And in India, he negotiated a new deal. They were posed to buy weapons from a French weapon industry somewhere, and he redirected that whole deal to Sweden, to Bofors. And I think that was probably that was probably a lead in the investigation that was never precisely investigated, and so. That was also Rajiv Gandhi, as you know, were killed too, or assassinated.
Right, yeah. Yeah, they were meddling in a lot of international
affairs.
I'm
not sure that this is relevant for our discussion here at Red Radio, but anyways, it brings us back to Palme.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's interesting, you know, because Sweden has been in a kind of a free fall for many, many years now. And it's really culminated, I think, in the last couple of years, 2014 and this year, 2015. And I mean, it's just, I don't even know where to begin to try to describe it. We talk about it so regularly on the show that I think a lot of listeners are familiar with it in some context. They know about some of the things that are going on. They're seeing what is happening. I think Sweden, it literally is the canary in the coal mine, so to speak, in terms of what is going to happen with the state of multiculturalism, with the state of us being part of the European Union, and us just basically heading into free fall and collapse. How do you view what is happening in Sweden right now? How would you describe it to somebody?
Well, I would say, since you're talking to me from the United States, I think there is an admiration on this on the part of the Swedish government, and has been always, for the United States of America, because that is a state which has been based on the explicit integration of all immigrants. And this is the history of the United States, and that is somehow a beacon of light for the Swedish society. Why? I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'm asking myself the same questions as so many other people are in this country, and I cannot come to a very convincing conclusion, I'm sorry, as to why Swedes want to be the A student, want to be the best in showing the world that we have the greatest tolerance, the greatest acceptance of everything, and we are willing to import any amount of people to resettle our country, and at the end of the day, to get rid of the original Swedes, as a matter of fact.
Yes. Well, you have some interesting thoughts on this, some theories, if you will, in terms of how Sweden have developed over the years of going from, well, obviously, if we have a pre-Christian time as well, but we've gone from Roman Catholicism over to Protestantism very, very easily. But then there has been a continuation on that Protestantism of a continuous reformation towards purity, if you will. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, you are referring obviously to my latest book, which is called the State of Crones or Bitches. And the thing, when I made my historical studies on this subject, I came to the conclusion that we have in Sweden since about 400 or 500 years Protestantism, which was, as you said, replacing the old Catholicism. But within this religion, there is a strong sense of self-guilt. You have to impose guilt on yourself. I mean, that's part of Christianity, that you're a sinful person. You experience guilt in your own existence. And this is something that you would have to ultimately declare to God and say, I am a sinful person. I'm just a human being. Now, this was carried on over the centuries. It started with the kings that were the Swedish kings back in those days that just saw, I think, that Gustav Vasa and Gustav II Adolf and etc. I think they just saw the opportunity to confiscate the riches of the church back then.
Right. Well, that's pretty interesting. Tell us more about how this development occurred. I mean, we have a transformation also, of course, within the tradition at the time of trying to understand God, and through Calvinism and through many other kind of traditions.
Yes, and of course, Protestantism also came out of Luther's Reformation. That he had been to Rome, and he had seen what he felt to be the decadence of the papacy and all that, and that they were not based any longer on the Gospels. And the Gospels actually preached that man should be poor and should live like Christ himself. So he wanted to come back to the man. He wanted to come back to what the Gospels told us about Jesus Christ himself, as opposed to the Catholic world has an idea of that the church is actually there to take responsibility for your actions. So they are actually alleviating your sin and your guilt in a sense. You can go to the church and the priest will tell you, okay, I listened to what you had to say. Now you say Ave Maria 10 times and you'll be fine.
Right.
So these people could get rid of, in a sense, I mean, as long as they trust the church as being the intermediary between God and society or the individual person. They had this possibility of doing this, so they can actually discharge their own inner tension. Protestantism, on the other hand, builds on a continuous inner tension of the soul. And this inner tension of the soul is bound to seek its own essence in relation to some unknown entity called God. And since we do not find God normally in our everyday life, we can just say that we feel guilty of something. And this is the basis of my book, is where I start out, is that there's a sense of guilt somewhere, and which has been very skillfully administrated and manipulated by forces that I don't really know who they are and what they are, but they have been manipulated so that nowadays, although we live in a completely secularized society, we experience more guilt than ever.
Remarkable.
Yeah, this is remarkable. So we have this sense of guilt that we are, the Swedes, were never really part of the colonial powers. They have not really, we never had any slaves. We were never engaged in all this, back in the days we were engaged in warfare. But in recent centuries, Sweden has been a very peaceful country trying to stay out of trouble. So where does this tremendous sense of guilt come from? This is my question.
Yeah.
And this is a question that is now administered and manipulated to the end of saying that we have a collective guilt for all the things that have happened to all the people of the world. And the answer to all this is to bring them all into Sweden so that we can repair somehow what we have done to them in the past. And I, to tell you honestly, Henrik, I don't really know what we have done to them.
Right. No, I agree with you, but it is a kind of an original sin, which is...
Yes, original sin. Yeah. It has something to do with that we're sinful, and now we have to pay. And we even have politicians in Sweden that tell us this, that there is a collective guilt,
yep,
and somehow we got to pay it. And this was the vice president or vice prime minister who even said this publicly on television.
You're thinking about Mona Sahlin, the problem with whiteness, right?
Not only the problem with whiteness, she was down there where all the refugees were coming over the Mediterranean, and she said that now it's pay time, you know, it's payday.
Right.
Not payday, but it's time to pay. And so we have to take them because we have a guilt, because we have a responsibility. Somehow we are self-appointed ambassadors of solving the problem of the world.
Yeah, we're going to do it better than any other country. See, this is what's interesting. It's still a need to be supreme in the self-hatred, right? Isn't that what's going on?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There you got it. Exactly that. It's to be the most self-inflicting person, the one who takes the greatest guilt upon himself or herself. That's going to be us. And there's no historical reason for this, really.
What about, this does come up, obviously, but the Second World War, our non-participation there.
Okay, so let's put the Swedes in perspective in the Second World War.
Yep.
Okay, we remained what was called neutral during that war. And there were some things that we were forced or felt forced to do, such as allowing German transports through Sweden of the German military. And there were also some other things that were where we were. I'm not sure what it's called when they, the Baltic people that we actually sent back to Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They were refugees and they were sent back to Germany somehow.
Right.
I mean, these things in the whole scheme of the Second World War, in the whole situation, those are tiny bits and pieces as opposed to what other nations were involved in.
Right.
So there is really no reason for the Swedes to feel that our role in the Second World War was so horrible that it cannot even be pardoned.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'm a more of a revisionist. I understand a little bit more. I'd like to think than some people in terms of the rise of National Socialism and why it occurred, and also the response it was giving to communism, which was ready to consume Europe. So obviously, I'm on a completely different page.
Not only
there.
Ready to consume Europe, it did.
Eventually, it did, of course. But I wonder where they would have been if Nazi Germany wasn't there to sacrifice themselves, if we will, as a nation, to try to stop some of it in its tracks. You know,
that is an interesting question, of course, and very controversial that you bring up. But of course, National Socialism came as a response to Bolshevism. That is clear, because
yep.
Bolshevism was on its way to also conquer Germany, as you know.
Yes.
And these things were about to happen. And then Hitler came and started to say, okay, we're going to make a socialism, but it's going to be national socialism. But in my view, it has to be understood that the Nazi ideology was also a kind of socialism. And I'm opposed to both, as a matter of fact, both the National Socialism and the Bolshevik version of the same.
But what do you think this has to do with us today? People who are alive today, many who wasn't even born when this kind of stuff was going on. It's we're back in the religious court again, when this is something which is tied to who we are as human beings. Almost, again, it's original sin tied to our DNA or structures as human beings or something.
I don't think so. Absolutely not. I mean, the concept of original sin was unknown to people in antiquity. As a matter of fact, good and evil are pretty recent concepts. They come with the Christian church. The older distinction was between good and bad.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And bad was meant that he was not good enough. And there was no connotation of a God that sits there and says that you are born as a sinful person. That was unknown to the Romans or Greeks or whatever whoever lived at that time.
Interesting.
So this is something that comes with Christianity, and this is something that we are still somehow, even in a secularized society, still spinning around, still wanting to come out, that we have some guilt that we have to get rid of. And this is, well, this is only the beginning of the book, as a matter of fact, that you're referring to.
Right.
And
yep. This
is my historical survey of the thing. Of course, since things have developed in very different directions. But the basic concept is somehow that we have something that we need to pay, a guilt or a debt that we need to pay off. And this is why they can actually incite a whole population into believing that we have something, some kind of responsibility for solving the world's problems, because we are so guilty in the end. And this is something that's very hard for me personally to understand.
Yeah, I was looking here a little bit about the there's an interesting way that Sweden has interpreted the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of the Citizen, and also consequently later after World War II, when Eleanor Roosevelt was coming up with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and all that kind of stuff. But this idea that there's an inherent equality or an equal value that is put on all humans. Some people have said that Sweden has taken this. It's almost like a mistranslation, a misunderstanding of the interpretation of these texts, and run with them, right?
Yeah, so of course, if you go back to the declaration in the French Declaration of Human Rights, it is stated they don't speak of equal value, they speak of equal dignity. And this is still in a sort of aristocratic way. They are tuning into the language of that time. So they're talking about dignity. Value, as a matter of fact, there are some very problematic things here, because if you say that every person is equal or that every person has the same value, then you are actually saying that you are making a comparison. You're saying, okay, value can only be established by comparing things. And at the same time, you say, no, these people, and no person can be compared to anybody else. They're all unique. So how can you establish a value then?
Exactly. There's nothing to
relate to. No. If you cannot compare things, you cannot establish a value. Then you could just as well say, well, we're all as worthless.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I guess that's how they view us these days.
We should come to that. We're all as worthless, so it doesn't really matter.
Well, I find it interesting, too, that this judgment, if you will, seems to be independent of people's actions then, that actually what you do as a human being it's going to make you rise or fall in value in the eyes of other people, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It's just that's why I don't buy the equality, nonsense, basically, because it's as you said, there's nothing to compare it to. What it means if we're all the same and all equal, then there's no value in any of us.
Exactly. We could just be, as I said, we could just be as worthless, etc. The problem is, of course, also that when you make a comparison and you say somebody's more valuable than somebody else, then you are starting to create what they call a hierarchy. And they don't want a hierarchy. They want to erase that concept from society altogether. Meanwhile, these people are still in power. And so they're at the top of the hierarchy. But that should just be regarded as that they are the elected representatives of the people, and that they are just as worthless, as a matter of fact, as anybody else. I would say they're more worthless than anybody else. But that
oh,
is
yeah.
my personal opinion.
Well, I agree. I don't...
The thing is, of course, that judgment can never be suspended. I mean, you could be a Buddhist monk and say, okay, to understand the essence of the universe, I need to be non-judgmental, because how can I have an opinion on the galaxies or on the sun or the planetary system or anything like that? Of course, it's meaningless to have a value judgment in relation to that.
Right.
But on the other hand, when we deal with people in everyday life, judgment is indispensable. That's what we need all the time. When you go on the bus, you make a judgment as to whether the chauffeur, the driver, can get you to from the station where you are entering to where you get off. And you say, okay, I trust this guy to do this. So that's a judgment.
Yes.
And even if you say everybody is of equal value, then that's also a judgment.
Of course.
So you cannot avoid having judgments.
Well, this is how we function as human beings. We know that they're trying to remove or paint such things as discrimination in a bad light, but I think they're going against human nature and the very aspect that we have always discriminated against things in one way or another in order to survive.
I'm sure you know from your personal life, as I know from my personal life, I prefer this person, I value him higher than the other.
Of course.
And another person. I mean, and this is what we all do on a regular daily basis.
Yeah, we can, someone else pointed out in this show before, I think it's a good line, but you discriminate against your shirts in the morning, depending on the fact that you pick one and choose one. You can't just, you know, I'm going to wear all of them because it makes me feel bad. I mean, it's kind of a silly example, but nonetheless, it's about the fact that you have to, as they say, a friend to all is a friend to none, right? There's no... when we don't make any kind of selections or trying to be impartial, a kind of a non-existence seems to occur, that we're not even you know, marking ourselves as physical beings.
Henrik, this is exactly what's happening to Sweden. We are turning ourselves into a non-existence.
Yes.
And nobody's going to admire us for that. Nobody, not even the immigrants that we receive in Sweden, will admire us. On the contrary, they will feel contentious. They will feel that we are weak, that we are stupid.
Yeah.
On account of all this.
Absolutely. You know, I want to move on to that and talk about the situation with immigration in Sweden as well. But one more thing I want to ask you about this, all of these kinds of points here. What's interesting is that, yes, they are anti-hierarchy, but at the same time, it has to be recognized that they do have a hierarchy of victims. And something interesting occurred a while back when this politician, I forget her name now, but she was making some stupid comments on some of these migrants, refugees, as they call them, that were dying in the Mediterranean, drowning, and she compared this to the Holocaust, basically, and all hell broke loose in the Swedish media. She was getting all kinds of flack.
That was our vice prime minister who said that,
right?
And this was very interesting. It was a very symptomatic case. But then, of course, Henrik, you have to realize that then we're bringing the Jews into the question, which makes it even more complex.
Absolutely. Oh yeah.
Because they want to be the prime victims, so yep. They, in my view, and you have to forgive me for presenting this on the air, but in my view, they are the ones who have been very successfully manipulating our sense of guilt.
Oh, of course, you don't have to apologize for that. We've talked about this many times. So,
okay,
yeah.
So this is a free radio.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Okay, fine. So this is what I want to say, is that they have been very skillful after the Second World War in inculcating in all of us Europeans, and even Americans, of course, but in the whole Western Hemisphere, by and large, this sense of guilt that we have somehow towards them. Although we were not there, we were not Nazis, we were not even born.
No.
So how can we be responsible for that? Unless, of course, you assume, as they do, that there's some kind of original sin. And that we Christians, or whatever we want to consider ourselves, are inherently guilty of some crime against the Jews from the time of Moses, or I don't know what. I'm sorry if I'm deviating from your question. But
No, it's great. I want to talk more about this. I mean, they have taken a good virtue that we have of kindness and trust and basically our good nature, and they're exploiting that and using that against us as a weakness, right?
Exactly. And the Arabs that now come in droves and swarms are not going to appreciate us for our meekness, as you know, the meekness of our population who says, okay, welcome, blah blah blah. No, they're going to find us weak, and this is a fact.
They have a very different culture, right?
Yeah. And also, because this is exactly what happens, I might give you an example that happened to me many, many years ago. I gave a gift to one of the I was in Africa, and I gave a gift to one of the boys that were actually taking care of a house. So he was a servant in the house, as a matter of fact. And this is an African situation. And he got this one. He said, thank you. And the next time I came and said, what are you bringing me? What are you bringing me this time?
Right, exactly.
So the thing is, of course, and this is, if I may, let's make go to what happened just today in the gypsy camp in Malmö. They're saying, you cannot bring us out here. You're treating us worse than animals. Well, what is your right in the first place to occupy a public space in Malmö?
Right.
But they feel that, and then there was the TV reporter from Sweden who says, well, don't you want to go back to your own country? No, we need the money.
It's great here. Yeah, we get so much money and help. And,
yeah, it's great here, but yeah. Exactly. Provide us with shelter, provide us with this, and this. Okay, fine.
Hand over your shekels, Swedes. You know, they
and this is only one instance. You know, there are so many of them. And I think we're just being naive and we're being stupid. That's what I feel.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. It's a very, very dangerous situation that's arising now. We can sit here and laugh about the absurdity, but there is real threats.
Exactly, and that's why I write about the feminist state. We could laugh about feminism because it's risible. It is really laughable. But it is actually in power. And this is the gravity of the situation.
Tell us about that connection. We'll talk more about the immigration crisis, the invasion that we've seen both into Sweden and Europe later. But tell us how you see that these two are connected. How has feminism aided to lead us to the situation we're in now?
Well, feminism, first of all, is based on Marxism. And the Marxism, it departs from the idea that there is a social class conflict. And back in the days, it was only considered the European worker. Now, we don't really have any workers' movement any longer in Sweden. I mean, that has been abolished. They're better off than most rich people today. So we cannot even put workers in the streets any longer.
No.
The industry has been automatized. The workers are doing fine. Let's say the domestic workers, the ones who used to be Swedes or are Swedes. But the thing is, now we have to create a second proletariat. And this is what we are bringing in now so that we can continue the Marxist revolution, which is about to bring all of the traditional societies down. And for some reason, Sweden has been assigned itself as the test tube for all this. This is where it's all going to happen. We are going to show the way to the future. And this is what they are all sort of infatuated with.
Yeah, Sweden has picked up on what's called the Nordic model. It's really formed largely by the Swedish economic system as well, but it's some people call it the third way economy or the third way politics. It's kind of a way, you can see this with the moderate party, which is laughably so, but supposedly the conservatives of Sweden, right? But they have done more in this respect to fulfill this very goal than what even some of the social democrats managed to do.
I think the reason why they won the elections, what was it, 8 years ago?
Yeah,
that they started. It was only because they took over. They just said, "Okay, we're going to adopt social democrat policies, and we're going to become like them." And that's how they won the elections. I unfortunately think that most Swedes are social democrats, so that's what they will listen to always.
Well, we have this idea of high trust in our
in the government, in the state. And that comes from the Protestantism, when Protestantism was integrated into the state by the kings in the 16th and 17th centuries. It was integrated into the state apparatus, and this is where it all happened. It started to happen, and this brings us back to history. But most Swedes will not delve that deeply into these causes in the past because they think that their society has been created yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's an interesting point too, because you know, we spoke about this earlier a little bit about the lack of appreciation for history or understanding of history of many Swedes that are alive and benefit from what the country has to offer today. That there's no recognition in the fact that our ancestors, they did what they did so that we can benefit from the privileges of being in the situation we are today, where we have the luxury to sit around and yap about feminism and Marxism and these kinds of things instead of solely focusing on surviving on a physical level.
Basis. But Henrik, you're absolutely right there. And the horrible thing is that these feminists, they don't even ask themselves, where do the refrigerators and the cars and the streets and the houses and everything, where do they come from? who's doing the Boeing? Who's doing the Airbus? Who's making all these things happen?
Yeah.
They just take it for granted. Like, okay, I come into the shop and it's all there. And so they have no sense whatsoever of how our ancestors, I'm talking generally ancestors, but I'm also talking about individuals, scientists. Sweden has a great tradition of scientists, are well known. And as you know, we have the Nobel Prize, and that's for a reason, because we have a great tradition of scientists who have improved the quality of living in society through industrialism and applied inventions that were made by Swedish scientists. We also have a great tradition of artists and writers and everything. And now we have feminists who say we don't have any Swedish culture whatsoever. It doesn't exist.
Yep, that's right.
And that is just like, to me, it's like spitting somebody in the face, saying you're a piece of shit. Okay. Well, okay, I can admit, I'm a piece of shit, but don't tell me that all of my ancestors were.
Well, they're spitting their own grandparents and great-grandparents in the face when
exactly.
they do this.
Exactly, and it's so odd that you have this sense of no sense of gratitude, no sense of recognition, no sense at all of a historical continuity.
Exactly. They worked so hard, struggling, literally dying
imagine,
in the fields.
Can you imagine how these people struggled in the past centuries to even survive in this cold, inhospitable climate?
Yep, exactly.
And we sitting here now, we have central heating and we have beautiful places. We have computers, we have telephones, we have warm baths, we have food, everything. Where does it come from?
Yep.
Who's providing us with this? Who made it possible? And these may sound like very elementary things, but I think we need to think about.
Well, they're remarkable.
They are remarkable. Yes.
It's like a ask a fish how it is to swim in the water. It couldn't tell you. We're in it all the time that we don't have that perspective and appreciation for it. But they are really wonders that we have through our ingenuity and engineering skills come up with. Not only Swedes, of course, but we've been very participatory in bringing up the standards of the Western world and whatnot. But it's
exactly
really,
I cannot understand this hatred against the Western civilization, where the white man suddenly, in feminist terminology, becomes the enemy per se. He is the evil one, and he's the one who provided them. I'm sorry if that sounds harsh. But provided them with all these benefits.
Yep, that's right.
I mean, do you think there would be a feminist movement down in the 15th century or where you live off the land and probably perhaps not even survive the winter?
Well, it's a delusion that they think that somehow these roles that have arisen among the sexes is some kind of a fabrication, that they didn't arise out of necessity of survival, that the family unit, especially...
Not only that, not even the sex is biological. It's a social construction.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, look, come on, my friends, look at evolution, history. The sexes are in nature everywhere, and you have the copulation between male and female in nature everywhere. Do you think are we just going to get out of that? How is that going to happen?
Well, they're trying, aren't they? They've like surgery and gender fluidity. And I read an article the other day here. There was a proposal now turned in by the RFSL, this organization lobbying for like gay rights and whatever in Sweden. They're actually a very powerful organization. They've been around since the 70s. And they recently released a report to the government. And the government was now looking at this. But it was basically... One, trying to get the age down for who legally can do a sex change. Yep. And then also on top of that, making actually a physical removal of the genitals. They wanted to get that down in age as well. And the Swedish government is looking at this as a serious proposal, you know?
Yes, I know. And they're looking at, and of course, they're defending abortion rights and all this. So we should respect all life and every life form and everything. But when it comes to, for instance, abortion, we should have the complete jurisdiction over taking away human lives. And I'm not, I'm not an abortion, what is it called, an abortion opponent or whatever. Mm-hmm. I can understand that there can be situations where that, but all the same, It is an alarming sign that we are, on the one hand, completely despising everything that the Western civilization has created and tell and just say that this is only good for giving away to whoever comes in here. We're going to give them to them. And at the same time, we reserve the right to judge over life and death.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't homeschool a child in Sweden for fear of imposing the biases of the parents on the child, but it's perfectly okay to reassign literally their gender at age, you know, 14 or 15. I mean, that's child abuse.
It's an absurdity.
Absolutely. It's I can't believe it's gotten this far, to be honest. But I mean, that's why this won't last. It's not going to work in the long run. What we're seeing is going to collapse, and I think it's happening literally right before our eyes right now.
I completely agree with you, Henrik, and let's move on to the second half of our interview.
Yeah, we're going to take a break here in a little bit, and we're going to continue to talk more about the invasion into Europe, the immigration, what some of the consequences of this might be. There's so many things here. We'll talk a little bit more about the book too, of course, but let's give out some of the details so people know, first of all, where they can go to pick up copies of your books. I do want you to mention some of the titles that you have available. And of course, if you have any personal websites or, I don't know, Facebook pages or Twitter or anything like that you'd like to give out so people can get in touch with you.
I don't really have a homepage, but my books are readily available on Amazon, for instance. They're also, so Amazon.com in the United States and also Amazon in Europe, in France, in Germany, in England. And they're also available, of course, by my publisher, which is Arctos.com. That's my publisher in recent years of my works. And that's the easiest way. But you can also find them on Amazon and a lot of other internet book sites.
Yep, absolutely. Now, how much of your works are translated into English? Is the majority in Swedish, or...?
Well, they're not translated. They're actually written in English.
Oh, okay. So, great. I mean, yeah, perfect.
I guess I have like six, seven books at least written directly in the English language.
We will have some of the links to these up on the website, folks. You can check them out, read more about them, and of course pick up copies if you want to find out more. Some very interesting ideas and thoughts from Lars Holger Holm here. We'll hear more of those in the second hour. So stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Lars. We'll be right back with the second hour. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoyed the first hour and want to hear more, please join us for the second hour coming up at redicemembers.com. If you're not yet a member, sign up and acquire a membership. It's only €5 per month, and we have 3 month up to 2 year subscriptions available for you. In the members segment, we weigh up the possible outcomes for Sweden in its shuffle to absorb tens of thousands of evacuees that are being extruded from violent, war-torn countries. Lars emphasized the conundrum the country faces as many of these people go underground, setting the scene for a great criminal paradise. We discussed the grand scheme of globalism and the Kalergi plan for a multicultural Europe, along with the costs associated with integrating contrasting and incompatible cultures. Lars illustrates how Sweden's emasculated governing powers are naively steering its people down the road to an ethnic and economic suicide. We also consider what it will take to get people to wake up and realize the madness of welcoming invaders with conflicting morals and the intense animosity towards European culture, and much more. So don't miss the second hour for a very important continuation on the future of Sweden. We have more coming on Red Ice Radio as well, of course. Erin Elizabeth is up next on the recent slew of deaths among the field of holistic doctors. We also speak with Sam Dixon, Jenny Upton, and many more after that. For now, we say thank you for listening, but please go to redicemembers.com and join us for much more in the second hour. We'll speak to you right after the break.